live up to.
Okay.
You're being recorded.
Okay. Introduce.
Go ahead.
Go introduce. You're on the air.
Hello and welcome to killradio.org. This show is the other side of the news, lunch hour. This show focuses on environmental issues, Indigenous struggles and political prisoners. Presently, we will be interviewing Hank Jones, a member of the San Francisco Eight, who is currently on bail at the moment and will be discussing a range of issues. So pretty soon we're going to be having some music, and after the music we will be speaking with Hank Jones. And we also have someone else in the studio as well, who's also part of the show. I'm Marissa, and this is Rob here.
Hi, this is Rob, and I will be talking about the truth about Thanksgiving later on during the show. And to start off the show, there was an artist by the name of Glenn Danzig who recently played out here in Griffin Park in L.A. And I'm going to start off the show with two songs by him. This first one's called Night Chill by Sam Hain and Snakes of Christ by Danzig. Please stay in tune.
Remember, you will surely die.
We're introducing here Hank Jones, who is a member of the San Francisco 8. Welcome back to killradio.org. But before we actually go into the interview, Rob, did you just want to announce the songs that have been played so far?
Hi, I just announced the phones earlier again. That was Sam Hain, Glenn Danzig's second band, Night Chill, and also his latest fan solo project, Snakes of Christ by Danzig.
So this show is called The Other Side of the News Lunch Hour, and we're now speaking with Hank Jones, member of the San Francisco 8, who is currently on bail right now. I wanted to also make a statement. We wanted to make a statement, actually. I wish to state that this interview shall not be used for personal and financial intent. And for anybody who wishes for more information or who would like to contribute in any way, please be directed to www.freedomarchives.org. And without any further ado, hello, Hank.
Oh, hi, Marissa.
Hi. Thank you so much for coming onto the program. You might want to speak up just a tiny
tad. Okay. Is that better?
Yeah, that's better. This is Guerrilla Radio, and our equipment is kind of a little bit rustic.
All right.
Thank you so much. I wanted I was wondering if you could briefly just give a little bit of an introduction about what's been happening and what the San Francisco 8 is.
All right. The San Francisco 8 are former members of the Black Panther Party and activists who were targets of an investigation concerning a police killing back in 1971 in San Francisco. And the investigation was recently reopened. The new investigation began in 2003. And recently we were all incarcerated and held for approximately 8 months in the San Francisco County Getting Jail. And this is all preliminary to a preliminary hearing. There's been no preliminary hearing in this case. But to go back to the origin of this, in 1971, as I said, there was an alleged murder of a policeman in San Francisco. And the two lead detectives on this case focused on members of the Black Panther Party and activists associated with the Black Panther Party. They drew up a list and began to go around interrogating people. And in 1973, there was a roundup of 13 people in New Orleans, and amongst them were three members of, four members of what we call the San Francisco 8, but four members of what they alleged to be members of the Black Panther Party. And people that they were associated with in New Orleans. Three of the people rounded up, Reuben Scott, John Bowman, and Harold Taylor, were tortured over the course of about 3 or 4 days there, illegally, without the knowledge of their attorneys, and forced to confessed falsely to the crime in San Francisco and to implicate others. And so this evidence was, there were attempts at to try this case based on this evidence, and two times prior it was thrown out of court due to the coerced coerced confessions. And that was in 1973 and 1975.
Right.
So what we have today, and this was all, I should say that the investigations and the persecutions of these men was all under the FBI's COINTELPRO operations.
Yes.
That's the counterintelligence program that was mounted against activist organizations and individuals, and eventually focused on the Black Panther Party in 1969 is when it the Black Panther Party became the primary focus. But it began in 1967, and the effort of the COINTELPRO operations was to neutralize, disrupt, and destroy, or they called it, neutralize, which was a code word for destroy the Black Panther Party. And I think the most blatant example of the extremes that they would go to would be, or that they went to, was the murder of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark in Chicago.
Yeah.
And brothers were set up by an agent provocateur who had infiltrated the organization and was actually the security chief and he was working with the FBI. Mm-hmm. Under the COINTELPRO operation, drugged the members of the party that were in the apartment, drugged their Kool-Aid, and then the assault began. And while they were in this drug-induced state, Mark Clark was murdered, and Fred Hampton was murdered in his drug-induced sleep. So that was in 1967,
right.
I believe. Afterwards, party members, that sent an alarm throughout the Black Panther Party and the activist community. And what it said to us was that federal government and agencies of the government were determined to take us out by any means necessary, including murder. So, being alarmed in this way and fearing, under constant mortal fear for our lives, some of us had to, go underground or leave the country. Some, left the party. So the overall effect was to put a chilling effect on dissent in the country. And in 2003, under the Homeland Security and the Patriot Act, the case was reopened. It was an unsolved crime, so it was reopened, and the same two lead detectives that oversaw the torture of the three party members, alleged members of the party in New Orleans, took the lead on the new investigation of this unsolved crime. And they began coming around, interrogating, questioning people all around the country. They came to my door in 2003, it was January 2003, and they came and they allegedly invested, what they stated to me was that they were allegedly investigating a white activist. And did I have asked me if I had any information or if I would volunteer information concerning these people, including Marilyn Buck. And so I didn't offer anything. And I told them that if they needed anything from me, they needed to get a court order. And so a few months later, they came back with a court order for fingerprint samples, and I could either submit to that or go before a grand jury, a secret grand jury. And I submitted the fingerprint samples, and because my fingerprints were on file anyway, so saw no reason why not. And I submitted to that, and it was at that point that we realized that it wasn't just white radicals or white individuals that they were concerned with, that they were obviously investigating us. So we got sought help from attorneys. And we then began to mount some kind of create some kind of a strategy to defend against this what we felt was illegal and unconstitutional activity. We were brought before secret grand juries from 2003 to 2005. And on several occasions, and eventually we were held in five of us were held in contempt of a grand jury for refusing to cooperate with what we thought was unconstitutional and illegal, and we were incarcerated for approximately 6 weeks. Which coincided with the termination of that particular grand jury. And
so they were even trying to get that case reopened even back then, weren't they?
That's right. And you know, these secret grand juries, you go in and you're alone. Your attorney's not allowed in the room with you, and you're actually grilled or interrogated about associations and your beliefs. And so we, you know, we stood on our constitutional rights and were held in contempt. Mm-hmm. And that was in 2005. And in 2006, it coincided with the renewal of the Patriot Act. They came around requesting with warrants for body searches, which were DNA samples, and we were forced to submit to DNA samples, mouth swabs. And this was, they alleged that they had new methods, and this was supposed to be new evidence. Well, as it turned out, not one of us matched any of the alleged DNA that they had, so that you know, the premise for doing it appears to have been invalid. And we just felt that they did it to bolster the legitimacy of the Patriot Act. And as I said, it was at the time of the vote for the renewal. And so then, you know, and that was about the June of 2005.
Right.
In January 2006, we were arrested on a complaint filed by the state attorney general. And we've been locked up. Well, we were locked up until about the middle of August, and we are out on, six of us are out on bail. The other two are being held on trumped up charges on a case in New York.
This is one of those people is Herman Bell, I understand.
Herman Bell and Jahlil King.
Yeah. Yeah, they've already been in prison for 30 years or so already.
They've Jaleel's been in jail for 36 years.
Yeah.
Herman Bell for 34 years.
Yeah. So basically, Hank, this is really a continuation of COINTELPRO, isn't it?
It absolutely is. The Patriot Act, we view it as just another form of COINTELPRO activity. And COINTELPRO, by the way, was adjudged to be illegal and unconstitutional by the U.S. Senate Church Committee. And, they were told to desist and disband the operations. And all they did was convert it to a different form. And we feel that the Patriot Act is the new form.
Yeah, thank you so much for explaining the COINTELPRO program, because I think it's really not acknowledged, is it? Particularly not in the mainstream media.
And people need to understand that COINTELPRO, as the church committee determined, was illegal and unlawful, unconstitutional, and that they used the methods used were infiltrations, agent provocateurs, bad jacketing, where they would label someone a snitch or informer, anonymous phone calls, anonymous letter writing campaigns. They would go into the community and go to anyone that was supportive of the Black Panther Party and denigrate you and demonize you and try to separate you from your support.
And specifically, when the case against the Black Panthers was happening, or in the 1970s, there was also a lot of torture, wasn't there? Where confessions were extracted through torture. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. And most recently, it's revealed that in Chicago, it was a common practice in a certain area. I believe it was Area 2, they called it, in Chicago, where it was an ongoing practice to extract confessions and lock people up falsely. And that was the reason for the governor declaring a moratorium on the death sentence.
So the case was thrown out of court back in the 1970s.
Yeah.
And now they've reopened it again.
Yeah.
And the case is obviously ongoing. So without going into any of the legal stuff, let's talk about how we can help. How can the community assist the SF8? Is there a committee, a defense committee set up?
Yes, there is. We have a website. You can go to www.freethesf8.org, and you can also go to www.freedomarchives.org, and we appreciate you if writing to Jaleel Mutakin, or sometimes known as Jaleel Bottoms, at the San Francisco County Jail, and you can get their numbers, jail numbers, from the website. Donations can be made toward our defense to the you can send donations to the Committee for the Defense of Human Rights, and that's P.O. Box 90221 in Pasadena, California, 91109. Get informed. Our website has a wealth of information on it. Get informed and spread the word. Try to educate the public. We feel that this case and our attorneys, we have a great crew of attorneys, the best that you could buy if you had the money, but they're doing it pro bono. We feel very confident that at some point or another, we're going to prevail. And the case itself, we feel, is was taken up to continue to suppress, to create this climate of fear and intimidation, and to accomplish the continued suppression of dissent in the country.
Absolutely, and given that, you know, there are far more black people in prison than what there are white people.
Yeah.
The statistics show that, you know, and children of black and brown, you know, it's a bleak future for them in many ways, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It's
cutting us off at the knees here. They're destroying our future when they lock up our...
That's right. I think Rob wanted to ask you a question. Is it okay?
Yeah.
It's hard to understand.
I can barely hear Rob.
Oh, the microphone. Yeah.
It's hard to understand that the...
Can you hear?
No, I can't.
Can you hear me now?
Here, I'll pass you the phone.
Hi.
Hi, Rob.
I find that it's hard to understand the prosecution that's been done towards the members of the Black Panthers. As somebody, as an outsider, isn't it true that it was Black Panthers responsible for starting the morning breakfast programs that's utilized throughout the school systems?
Yeah, that was just one of the programs, Rob. But, you know, Black Panther Party was labeled by Hoover the greatest threat to the internal security of the country back in the 70s. But the second greatest threat, he determined the second greatest threat to the internal security of the country was the free breakfast program for school children. And in addition to that, there were, we had free clinics, health clinics. We had free sickle cell anemia testing programs. There was free clothing giveaways, free food giveaways. There was escort services for the elderly, you know, to make sure that they could go about their chores and not be harmed. And all of these things came out of the, were created by party members and those associated with the party, primarily party members, though. And the average age of a party member was 17 to 20 years old. I just want to say that they went into the communities. They placed themselves between the community and rogue cops who were holding court in the streets and executing young brothers and sisters. And they saw that there were needs in the community that our government wasn't addressing. They weren't being provided for. So the party members devised programs to fulfill those needs. The 10-point program of the party was about land, bread, housing, clothing, education, justice, and peace. And so all of this was the creation of young party members.
Yes, if you don't mind me mentioning that the historical aspect between the relationships of cops when they first originated, and also with African Americans here, that when the African Americans were enslaved, there were a lot of white people that were enslaved too, who were descendants of the European settlers.
That's right.
And the police force actually originated and started among whites who were slaves themselves. It was where the where the white slaves were policing the African American slaves. And that, and later on, Abraham Lincoln, it was, since Thanksgiving is coming up, I can also tie it in that it was Thanksgiving, it was Abraham Lincoln himself that declared Thanksgiving to be a national holiday, and before Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, he had plans to bring African Americans out of America and back into Africa. And there was also documentation and proof that he was a bit of a racist towards them as well. And yeah. It seems like it's all connected, not only towards the African American people, but also to all other people of colors and indigenous people here too.
Right. And, you know, the indigenous, the Native Americans. You know. And, you know, it's referred to as Thanksgiving, but it was more Thanks-taking back then. So, you know, it was a ripoff of the land of the Native Americans. And, slavery is, you know, I mentioned torture, but, you know, torture is not new to this country. How else would you break a slave if you don't exercise torture? And, you know, there's the famous or infamous Willie Lynch process of slave breaking. So, torture's not new. Everybody, though, understands that confessions derived through torture are not reliable. Most civilized nations understand that, but apparently the United States is not with that. You know, they seek to legitimize torture today. Evidence by the debate over waterboarding, whether that's torture or is not torture, which is ridiculous.
It seems like it's about social control, that whenever anybody within the community tries to organize the community, become self-efficient, that there seems to be all these criminal charges that seems to come out among the organizers themselves.
Right. The powers that be are concerned about one thing, and that's maintaining the status quo. They are realizing all the rights and privileges, and they're not in the mood to share. So, but then that's the history of that's part of the history of the country. All the way back to the the robber barons that carved out sections of the economy for themselves and want to maintain that to the present day.
I just have one more question, if you don't mind me asking. As an elder, someone who spent time organizing among the communities, do you have any advice for the newer generation today who wants to get involved actively among the communities?
Yeah, we were always organizing around issues. You know, find one that you have a gut feeling about. You know, and get involved. Start trying to create a change for the better. There's any number of issues to deal with out here. And I know in the black community, we're worse off than we ever were. So there's lots of work to do. A lot of people are concerned about getting out of their comfort zone. Well, you know, the consequence of that is you end up with a fascist state. You know, like what happened in Nazi Germany, or you see the drift toward fascism today in this country, the police state. Why are so many police necessary? And why are so many people incarcerated in the so-called free and open society in a democracy? These questions beg answers, and I think if we get out and start examining and questioning, we'll find that there is a definite need for a change.
And it's Marissa back again. And
yes, Marissa.
That was a really pertinent question that Rob asked. And I understand you've been here for a while now, and we really honour, you know, your time being on this program. But just what I wanted to ask you as well is, in terms of, is there still a documentary produced by freedomarchives.org about the torture that occurred in the 1970s?
Yes, it's called Legacy of Torture, the War Against the Black Liberation Movement. And if you go visit Freedom Archives website, you can purchase it.
Good, because I did want to correct that accuracy about where you actually get the documentary from. That's the actual website, isn't it?
www.freedomarchives.org. And there's five of us involved with the making of that are being interviewed in this documentary.
So, without going into any legal strategies whatsoever, are you at liberty to reveal any court dates that are coming up?
Yes, we have a court date December the 3rd in San Francisco County Jail. And it's, I think it's 9 o'clock.
9 o'clock?
I believe that's it. But if you visit the website, you can get the exact time.
That's lovely. Well, thank you so much, Hank, for coming onto the program at such short notice.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I know that trust has to be earned, and you agreed to come on, which is absolutely wonderful. So, for listeners who wish to download the show, or anybody who has missed out on this opportunity to hear this interview, you can download it from killradio.org on the website there. Okay, Hank, before we leave you, was there anything else that you wished to add to the interview, any concerns or anything that you wanted to share?
Well, yeah, I could have a concern about the complacency and the lack of there's a word that is kind of obscure today, but that we recognize and felt deeply back in the 60s and 70s, and that was empathy. And it's a lot different than sympathy. It's putting yourself in the place of another, standing in their shoes, experiencing and feeling what they feel. And I'd like to see us try to get back to a little of that and get back our humanity.
Absolutely. That's very, very true, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because, we sometimes there are ulterior motives, aren't there?
Yeah.
For doing things, and we need to operate from the heart.
We need to see ourselves as connected as we are, and not just here in this country, but the planet, and see our connection to the planet. It's obvious that we're destroying our environment.
Absolutely.
As well as ourselves.
Over in Australia, Hank, they're cutting the old growth forests.
Mm.
And the connection to the land is being lost. And in fact, I've done some work over in Australia with the Aboriginal people over there, trying to stop the old growth forests from being cut.
Well, we had a love for the people, and that was why we were activists, and we have had a love for the ideals of democracy, and we had a love for our environment. And this is what brought us out to the streets in protest. And hopefully this generation will come to that point.
That's right.
I mean, if they don't, then we're in dire straits.
I know. It's very true, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's a really good note to end on this interview, isn't it? And hopefully we can use this interview as a tool to educate the community and work, so that they can work out what's happening and correct some of the inaccuracies, some of the possible inaccuracies. And the 3rd of December court case is a trial, is that correct?
Yes, it's still, we're in the preliminary hearing stage.
Right.
And, well, actually, there's no preliminary hearing.
No.
We're still in the discovery stages.
Okay.
We're headed, hopefully, for a preliminary hearing.
That's okay.
Yeah.
All right, well, all power to the people.
All power to the people.
Okay, thank you, Hank.
All right, thank you.
And we'll talk soon.
All right, Marissa, you take care.
You take care and keep in touch.
I will.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we're back on Kill Radio again. That was definitely a very interesting interview that we just had there on the air. I'm going to go into is there anything you would like to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that we just spoke with Hank Jones, who is a member of the San Francisco 8 and who's currently on bail at the moment. And if people want to download his interview, it can be reached by going to killradio.org and clicking on archives. And I just wanted to also remind listeners that this show is called The Other Side of the News Lunch Hour, and it focuses on environmental issues, Indigenous struggles and political prisoners. And I do believe that Rob has an article to read about Thanksgiving. But before we do that, we're going to be speaking with Connie, who is who's going to be doing some work with the archives at South Central Farmers. But Rob is actually going to play some music first while I call Connie.
And you're back with killradio.org, and this show is The Other Side of the News Lunch Hour, focusing on environmental issues, Indigenous struggles and political prisoners. Now, one of the things that we are about to talk about, both directly and indirectly, is about the connection to land. And as we all need to understand, the earth is our mother. And on the phone, we have the director of the South Central Farm Archive Project. It's Constance Layton, and she will be talking about a very wonderful project to help the South Central Farm. I'm not sure whether listeners remember, I'm sure they do remember quite intimately actually, about the 14-acre property, the South Central Farmers, who are a great cooperative, who grew pre-Hispanic medicinal plants and vegetables, fruit and vegetables. And a developer actually took the farm away from them with the help of the police and the sheriff's department. The farm was demolished. The farmers were evicted sometime last year. And Constance has been doing a lot of really amazing work. And we'll be speaking with her about the history of the farm and also the grassroots project that she's working on right now. So, Constance, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Marissa. It's a pleasure to be on the program.
Yeah.
We're very excited about this opportunity to speak with you and the listeners about the South Central Farm Archive Project and about this valuable piece of land and how it has transitioned into an urban setting, into something that perhaps it doesn't need, that we don't need to have happen at this particular time in history.
That's exact. Constance, do you mind if I call you Connie?
Go right ahead.
Oh, it just sounds less formal.
Right. Actually, my formal name is Constance, and everybody knows me by Connie.
Okay, that's great. Thank you, Connie. Mm-hmm. So, Connie, can you describe to us how you became involved in this project?
Certainly. Several years ago, I started working for a farmer, Alex Weiser, Weiser Family Farms, and then another farmer, the Bernard family of Bernard Family Ranches. And that relationship ended up with five different farmers throughout Southern California working. I worked for these farmers at 26 different farmers markets. And what happened was this working relationship brought me to the food security industry and the farmers market industry and the need for fresh produce. And I saw a need for fresh produce access in low-income areas. As a result, I left my corporate job and went to work for a nonprofit organization. I went to work for two nonprofit organizations that helped provide farmers markets throughout Southern California and fresh food access programs throughout the Los Angeles area, specifically in low-income areas. In addition to that, I attended a USC Common Ground program, a Master Gardener program, took a class and became a Master Gardener program. One of the requirements is that you volunteer to communities to maintain that status or that certificate. And when I started working with the land that I became so connected that my life changed, and I knew that from then on I would be working with struggles that involved bringing fresh food access and connecting people to the land, specifically in low-income areas in Los Angeles.
That's fantastic.
And then what had happened as a result of that, I was doing work in nonprofits and I was approached by different agencies for positions, and I didn't have my degree at that point. So I finished my degree at Antioch University in the Urban Community and Environment Program, which focused on connecting people and communities in Los Angeles in an environmentally and politically conscientious and moral just way. It was a very fitting program for me. During the time I was finishing my degree, the South Central Farm struggle began. They started losing their land. And during one of my classes, I went to the Southern California Library for Social Studies and Research and saw an exhibit which had a piece of the South Central Farm reclaiming the land. And I knew when I graduated I needed to get back into the community, and I didn't know how I was going to get back involved with the community and because things had changed over the last 3 or 4 years. So what I ended up doing, I made a decision I need to give back to the community, and how would I do this? I would ask the South Central farmers if I could archive the history of their land. And their response, and I thought that was one way I could give back to them and back to the community, because I did not participate in the struggle. And so I met with a group of farmers, Tezomak and Rafina, and a whole group of supporters at the South Central Farm Community Center, and asked them if they could help me help me with the archiving of this project. And they said that would be a great idea, but they felt very strongly that all histories needed to be conducted in order to tell the story. So then the project began.
So basically, that's really impressive. And so, Connie, just to set the scene for listeners, when did you decide that, when did you speak to the farmers? Was it after the farm was demolished?
It was actually after the eviction occurred.
Okay, so after the eviction occurred, that's when you became involved, and that's actually quite crucial, isn't it? Because that's when everything vanished, so to speak.
Right.
But at the moment, what's happening is that there's rebuilding and regeneration, isn't there?
Right. It's even though the farmers aren't present on the land, there were 350 lots where people had farmed, so there were numerous families that had participated on that piece of land over a period of 14 years. And they divided. Many of them chose to go to community gardens in Watson and other areas through the Los Angeles Community Garden Council, helped make that happen. And so there were divisions. And then there was one particular group who really fought to preserve the land, and not just preserve the land, but preserve indigenous people's rights to the land and the ability for communities to have fresh food access, specifically low-income communities, have fresh food access in a sustainable way, and programs that promoted healthy eating and healthy living.
So just going back in time, can you briefly just, I suppose, plot a little bit of a history of what happened with the farm and why the farmers were evicted?
Well, certainly. It is a story, and my facts may be a little bit off. One reason for the archive, too, is I've seen many different stories and timelines of what had occurred, and I feel it very important to reference documents that give the actual facts. So some of my facts may be off because I
That's
may not
okay.
have the right information in front of me.
That's okay. It's only just a very, very brief history, and the main focus of the interview will be on the archive.
Okay.
I just wanted to set the scene.
Right. So in the early 90s, the property was taken away from a group of developers via eminent domain for a public project, which was to build an incinerator on that 14-acre piece of property. Then the community rose up and said, we don't want another incinerator in our backyard. And so that project was ended, did not take place. And then the riots came about. And after the riots came about, the city had approached the food bank and said, let's make a community garden out of this property. Can you help us do that? And the food bank said, of course. So the community garden turned into an urban farm, and the South Central farmers organized that piece of property and began growing their own food and grew food for themselves. And community members started coming into the farm and purchasing that food. So it became a self-sustaining community in its own right. They paid for their own their water. They paid space fees to maintain the property. And so that progressed over a number of years. During that time, there was the Los Angeles City moved or sold to the L.A. Harbor Department, that property and that agreement. And in doing so, that the developer, I believe, saw that happen. And he said, well, wait a minute. You took this land via eminent domain from me, and I have the first right of refusal. I have the first right to go and say, if you're going to sell it, you're going to sell it to me. So then that's where his fight with the city began. So he fought to get back his property. All along, the farmers had been farming on the property, the politicians had been politicking, using the people and the property, saying that, you know, that they're supporting, you know, that they, the
yeah.
politicians supported the farmers and the land, right? Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, there's negotiations in the back rooms going on with this developer who says, I want this property. Eventually, the property, the developer won his lawsuit. He sued the city and said, I want my property back. You went to sell it. You should have sold it to me. I get it back. That's my right. So meanwhile, the farmers are on the land saying, what are you doing? Telling the city, you know, this. How could you do this? And so they fought to reverse the decision. And there are a lot of facts that really need to come out in like, who was responsible, who actually had the right, where do the rights to the land begin? And I really want that archive to be able to bring that up. You know, why did it play out this way?
It's interesting, Connie, and you bring up some really important points here. And when we had our meeting on Monday, and we're discussing the archive, and in fact, isn't it interesting that you interviewed me on Monday for the archive, and now I'm interviewing you for the archive. It's a good thing, isn't it?
Right. It really is.
But I suppose one of the other aspects of the archive as well. As all that is the preservation of the medicinal plants and the fruit and vegetables, yes?
Absolutely.
And looking at the identification of the trees and the politics of it too, that's really important too, isn't it? And how unfairly the arrestees were treated, the police brutality that happened while the farmers were being evicted. So many issues, isn't it? You've got a big task, a big challenge ahead of you, and I'm sure you're going to do very well.
Right. Yeah, I believe that the land has a right to speak and to grow.
Absolutely.
And that right had been taken away. I think that there was a lot of inappropriate actions that were taken, and the people who were growing the land, they lost. I believe the developer lost as well. I mean, he ultimately has received his land back, and there's still an appeal in the case. I find it very interesting that the developer actually has a history of working with communities, and it's very interesting why was this community overlooked? You know, where did that motivation come from? And I really want to find out where that motivation come from, and I want the facts to be on paper, because I believe that when those facts come out, the Archive Project may not be a very popular archive in the eyes of our political leaders, and perhaps with developers. You know, I'm not sure. We'll see where the facts come. But beyond that whole political arena is what was grown on that property and what kept these people so connected to the land. When you know that there's an individual, a grandmother, who would bring her grandchildren from Venice, California, by bus to 41st and Alameda, every single day for a number of years, because that was a safe place and a healthy place to bring her children, and a healthy thing to do, to grow that produce and to teach them. When you know there are people are coming that length to that area, and now they've lost that, and you start hearing the stories of the farmers and what that land meant to them, then you start seeing why the fight became, the struggle became as big as it was, and why it remains. Because that green space is so valuable to that area on many different levels. And that's another mission of the archive, is to bring that level by conducting those oral histories. You know, that 14 years of the people farming on the land, that connection is really what's being lost.
You know, it's very true, Connie, and I was discussing this topic actually with some friends. And, you know, there are so many inaccuracies that I feel really will be corrected in the archive, in that they were saying, oh, but the farmers deserve to be evicted. Oh, it wasn't their land anyway. They should buy land of their own. And it's not about that. This is what I was trying to explain to people, that the mainstream media really doesn't highlight the connection to land. You know, it's all about money, and it's all about warehouse development.
Right. Well, the connection to the land is being lost, and that's one reason why we have such a problem with global warming, with the air quality, with, I mean, there's so many issues. That's why I think that the South Central Farm was looked at by so many different people on so many different levels, because it represented so very much. I think that so many people have been disconnected from the land through living in urban settings, that that it's hard for them to get back to why this is so important on those different levels. And I'm hoping that when the Archive Project, which is going to take a number of years, to conduct. We have a lot of people to contact, a lot of oral histories to take, a lot of different documents that need to be brought into the archive and housed so that people can come and do research that actually is of merit.
So it's going to be used as an educational tool, and basically, just to clarify, your role with the archive is not only to compile oral histories, but also to collect media and documents as well?
Absolutely.
Is that correct?
Everybody, if you were a farmer who grew food at 41st and Alameda, if you were an activist who fought to save the land, if you were a journalist who covered the South Central Farm, if you were in an academic setting or with an organization that conducted interviews, studies, reports, assessments that related to the South Central Farm or the general community around that area, your information is crucial to the archive.
Okay. We're actually running out of time, but I just wanted to ask you, Connie, as well, where is it that they can go? If we're sending out a call out to all these groups, where can they contact you?
If they Google SouthCentralFarmArchive.org, they'll come up with our homepage. They can go in, and there's a phone number as well as my email address. They can contact me directly on my cell phone at 310-439-4009. Or they can email me at ConnieDLew@AOL.com. That's C-O-N-N-I-E, D as in David, L-O-U, at AOL.com. They will receive a call from myself or our project coordinator, Enrica Penaloza. She is our project coordinator, and she is also our bilingual. She is bilingual in English and Spanish and has been very helpful to the project.
That's fantastic, Connie, and I think this is really, really valuable work. And before we go, just also that there's a community center, isn't there, that the farmers are working out of at the moment, yes?
Yes, at 41st and Alameda, a group of South Central farmers created a nonprofit and a community center called the South Central Farm Community Center, and it is at 41st and Alameda. Feel free to visit it. At the first Sunday of every month, they have their tiangas, and if you Google South Central Farm, you will also find their website, and you'll see what's happening, what news is current, what's going on with the farm, the cooperative, and how people can get involved.
And who knows, you might even meet Connie there, and you can connect up with her to talk further about the archive.
Absolutely. I welcome any calls. So if you have any question as whether your information has any merit to the archive or not, please give us a call. I also wanted to mention that all of the information will be archived according to archiving standards, and will be housed at the Southern California Library for Social Studies and Research, which is located in Los Angeles as well.
And the website for the actual farmers?
The website for the actual farmers, I believe, is the South Central Farm. Just Google South Central Farm, and there'll be one of the top list hits on your page.
Thank you so much, Connie, for coming onto the show.
Thank you. Thank you so very much.
No problem. And we will have you back regularly to discuss further how the archive is going. We'll be having you back to provide regular updates and regular contact information.
Thank you so very, very much.
Thanks so much. You have a wonderful, wonderful holiday.
You too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And you're back here at Keel Radio. This is Rob. That was a very interesting conversation that was held with Connie and Marisa. It's very important for self to be self-efficient and to remember about where our food comes from, and that I speak with a lot of people and talk about this very subject. And the one question it always seems to be: well, when you're living in an area that's so populated, where can you have room to grow? And definitely this is one example of what can be achieved within the city, and it's unfortunate that their land was taken away, that everything wasn't finalized before the owner of the land decided to take it from them, and hopefully that they will be able to gain more land back here in LA. Anything you'd like to add?
I just wanted to add that we're running out of time, and I understand that you had an article about Thanksgiving that you wanted to read out.
Yes, that being that tomorrow is Thanksgiving, I think that I would like to share with the listeners about what Thanksgiving is about and the origin of the meaning of it. Back in the rival, the Europeans on the east coast of North America occurred not in 1620, but well before the French and the Dutch fishermen settlers had been in the area as early as 1614, and had been responsible for kidnapping the Indians, selling them into slavery, and maliciously infecting them with smallpox. The French, one of the methods in their attempts to try to exterminate the tribe was that there was a black plague that was going on in Europe. They brought the infected blankets over to them, gave it to them as a gift of offering. And when the Native Americans took the blankets, they themselves got infected with smallpox. Now, back in 1620, the Pilgrims arrived in the East Coast, and within 2 days, they had arrived assistance from the local, excuse my mispronunciation to the people, the Wampanoag Indian tribe. The Pilgrims stole their crops, dug up graves for dishes and pots, but they also dug up the graves and taken corn that was an offering for the burials for them to eat, and took many native people as prisoners and forced them to teach crop planting and surviving techniques to the colonists in their new environment. Luckily for the colonists, an ex-slave named Squanto, who had recently escaped slavery in England, which also at the time that they took in the Native Americans as slave to work as servants, which now is known as butlers and maids, and so on, back to England. Since Squanto was taken as slave into England, he spoke English fluently and was able to instruct the Pilgrims in crop planting, fishing, and hunting. Squanto not only was a survivor of the smallpox from the European smallpox plague years before, when it came to helping the ragtag team of colonists, Squanto not only was able to put aside his personal differences with the people who had enslaved him and killed off his entire tribe, almost his entire tribe, but also helped make the colonists self-efficient, aided in breaking a treaty with his people, the Wampanoag tribe, in 1621. Excuse my mispronouncing here, Massasoit, the chief of the Wampanoags, assigned a treaty of friendship giving the English permission to occupy 12,000 acres of the land. In 1621, the myth of the Thanksgiving was born. The colonists invited the Massasoit chief of the Wampanoag to their first feast as following up to the recent land deal. In turn, invited 90 of his men, much of the charging of the colonists. 2 years later, the English invited a number of the tribes to a feast, symbolizing internal friendship. The English offered food and drink, and 200 Indians dropped dead from an unknown poison from the food and the drinks that they were given. The first day of Thanksgiving took place in 1637, amidst a war against the Pawgots. 700 men, women, and children of Ponkawatt's tribe were gathered for their annual green corn dance on what is now Groton, Connecticut. Dutch and English mercenaries surrounded the camp and proceeded to shoot, stab, butcher, and burn alive all of 700 people. The next day, the Massachusetts State Colony held a fast and celebration, and the governor declared a day of Thanksgiving. Ensuing madness of the Indian exterminations, native people were scalped, burned, and mutilated, and sold into slavery. It was quite a practice that the scalps were sold for a certain profit. The scalps of the children of the Native Americans were worth more in money than it was the scalps of the adults. And a feast was held in celebration every time a massacre was taking place. The killing frenzy got so bad that even the churches of Manhattan announced a day of Thanksgiving to celebrate a victory over the so-called Sathan Havages, the genus people of this land. And many celebrated by kicking the several heads of the native people through the streets like soccer balls. The proclamation of the 1676 announced the first national day of Thanksgiving with the onset of the Wampanoag War. The very people who helped the original colonists survive on the arrival, thanks to Squanto. So every time that a massacre that occurred, they had a feast and celebrated Thanksgiving, which is what the meaning of Thanksgiving. Next week, I will continue this and further talk about Thanksgiving, the history of it, and also that I will be reading also that I'll be reading from an excerpt taken from Russell Means, a Native American political activist autobiography called Where White Man Feared to Trend. I'd like to leave you now with a song to close for the show for today. Unfortunately, that we need to end it. Anything else you'd like to say, Marisa?
I just wanted to say, stay safe, everybody. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, happy Genocide Day. May we start a new tradition of Thanksgiving, of remembering the massacres that occurred in the celebration of how Thanksgiving once began as a celebration of their so-called successful victories, of their massacre, and then we start a new Thanksgiving, giving thanks to our health and to our loved ones in our lives as well. Thank you, and be safe. I'll leave you now with a song. The song before was by a band called Nail Bomb that was called Zero Tolerance. I will now end this show with a song by Sepultura, his main band, with a song called Aragatron that was originally written by Lenny from the band Motorhead.
Build my palace. Your eyes must dust my throne.